This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents All Too Human, A Political Education, written by George Stephanopoulos and read by the author.
Prologue. When I first considered writing about my time with President Clinton, I envisioned a political memoir shaped like a human comedy. A story of good, talented, but fallible people, acting on Vaclav Havel's hope that politics can be not only the art of the possible, especially if the possible includes the art of speculation, calculation, intrigue, secret deals, and pragmatic maneuvering, but that it can also be the art of the impossible, namely the art of improving ourselves and the world. I wanted to write a candid story that neither shied away from showing the art of the possible, nor surrendered to the cynical notion that there's nothing more to know about politics. I hoped it would explain how an ambitious and idealistic president of uncertain personal character grew in office, how he outsmarted his enemies, out-hustled his adversaries, overcame his failings and those of his team to help our country and achieve what no Democrat had done since Roosevelt, 2 full terms in office and a successful presidency. I believed it would be a story with a happy ending. But the plot took a turn. America has made more progress under President Clinton than I imagined possible. I remain proud of our accomplishments, but the events of the last year have changed the shape of the story I set out to write. It can no longer have a truly happy ending. I've done my best to recount accurately my thoughts, feelings, and the events as I perceived them at the time, but I couldn't avoid the filter of the president's affair with Monica Lewinsky and its aftermath. Throughout 1998 and early 1999, I lived in 2 separate Clinton worlds, the past that I experienced from the inside and the present I was observing from the outside. As the stories unfolded, one on my word processor and the other on the news, I came to see the connections more clearly and was tempted at times to think of the Clinton story as a tragedy. That doesn't seem quite right either. For all his talent, Clinton lacks the grandeur of a tragic hero. His presidency, however, does have the momentum of classic drama, the roller coaster ride from Clinton's improbable election in 1992 to his impeachment in 1998 is a narrative stocked with dozens of characters, hundreds of decisions, and 1,000 coincidences, all driving toward a conclusion that feels somehow, sadly, inevitable. This program tells my part of the Clinton drama. It covers 2 presidential campaigns and 4 years in the White House. From the day I met him in September 1991 to the day I left the White House in December 1996, Bill Clinton was the dominant figure in my life. Our relationship was intense, intimate at times, but not a personal friendship. The Clinton I know is the Clinton I show in this program, the politician and president at work. A complicated man, responding to the pressures and pleasures of public life in ways I found both awesome and appalling. As I wrote and rewrote, I came to see how Clinton's shamelessness is a key to his political success, how his capacity for denial is tied to the optimism that is his greatest political strength. He exploits the weaknesses of himself and those around him masterfully. But he taps his and our talents as well. I've not lost my conviction that President Clinton has done a great deal to advance our country, and that he has acted out of profound patriotism and concern for others. For every reckless and expedient act, there are others of leadership and vision. I don't know how President Clinton will react to the portrait presented here, but I've tried to provide a fair representation of his many-faceted personality. I've also tried to show the modern White House at work. For most of my tenure, I held a relatively amorphous job that was an amalgam of political troubleshooter, public relations advisor, policy expert, and crisis manager. Having vaguely defined responsibilities was often frustrating, but it allowed me to participate in a wide range of White House decisions. So much of the excitement of being a White House aide comes from having the chance to be a witness to history and to feel like you're making it. I hope my account will be a useful tool to presidential historians. In the end, however, this is neither a biography of Clinton nor a comprehensive history of his first term. It's a more personal story of what happened to me in the White House, what I saw and did, how I felt and reacted to the pressures of public life. Theodore White once wrote that closeness to power heightens the dignity of all men. I now know that's not always true. I know how often I let my own ambition, insecurity, and immaturity get the best of me, and I've tried to be honest about that as well. But I also know that even having the chance to make the mistakes I made is a tremendous privilege. Because for all the compromises and disappointments, for all the days when my job felt like an exquisite jail sentence, working in the White House was the greatest adventure of my life. I had my first taste of Washington life during my junior year at Columbia University as a summer intern for our congresswoman, a Democrat named Mary Rose Okar. The big legislative debate that summer was about Reagan's budget. Before that experience, I had volunteered for George Bush in 1979 and voted for John Anderson in 1980. But working against Reagan's budget made me a Democrat. I didn't think supply-side economics would work, and I didn't believe it was fair. Perhaps it wouldn't have happened had I had a different summer job. But unlike the millions of Democrats whom Reagan inspired to vote Republican, I was a Republican he pushed the other way. I couldn't have planned what came next. Everyone needs a break or two to get ahead. Mine came the night Norman Mayer was shot. I was working on nuclear arms control at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Norman Mayer was an older man with a deep tan, who wandered the streets of Washington in a nylon windbreaker, sunglasses, and a golf cap, looking like the caddy master at a country club gone to seed. He too was working on disarmament, but in his own peculiar way. If he caught your eye on the street, he'd hand over a pamphlet that promised $10,000 to anyone who could actually prove that nuclear weapons prevent nuclear war. Pretty lucid point for a deranged person. Occasionally, Mayer walked into our offices off DuPont Circle to lobby for his proposal. Since I was the lowest person on the totem pole, he was my responsibility. I'd offer him a sandwich and we'd chat uncomfortably until I could find a reason to excuse myself and usher him out the door. Not exactly what I had in mind when I imagined Washington Power lunches, but Norman seemed harmless enough. Until December 8, 1982. When I returned from lunch, my boss was waiting for me with a weak smile. "Your friend is holding the Washington Monument hostage," he said. "You'd better call the police." Dressed in a homemade spacesuit behind the wheel of a van he said was loaded with dynamite, Norman Mayer had driven up to the monument and threatened to blow it up unless he could broadcast his plan to prevent nuclear war. Washington was paralyzed and the world was watching on live television. After I called the police, reporters started calling me. So began my first foray into a media feeding frenzy. One of those times when everyone in the country responsible for bringing the news to the rest of us focused for a moment on a single event. TV bookers who fill the airwaves with talking heads work the phones to find anyone with even the most tangential connection to the event. That day, that someone was me. I was the guy who knew the guy who was holding Washington hostage. Nightline sent a limo. I actually said, "Well, Ted," on national TV before telling what little I knew about Norman. My parents made a video and calls came in from friends all over the country. To top it all off, a newly elected congressman from Cleveland named Ed Feehan was watching, one day after I had applied for an entry-level position in his office. Feehan called the next day. "If you can get yourself on Nightline, maybe you can do some good for me," he said. The job title was legislative assistant, which meant I would draft letters, memos, and speeches on whatever the congressman was working on. The salary was more than double my intern stipend. $14,500 a year. I was thrilled with my new job, but spooked by how I got it. Norman Mayer had been bluffing. There was no dynamite in his truck. But the police couldn't know that, so they shot him down near midnight when he tried to drive off the mall. "It's not my fault Norman got shot," I thought. I didn't turn the key or pull the trigger. Why couldn't he just surrender after making his point? Besides, I would have gotten the job anyway. I'm qualified. I'm from Cleveland. I'll work hard. Still. No, it wasn't my fault Norman got shot, but I couldn't escape the fact that his fate was my good fortune. I was a natural at the game of politics, and knowing who knew what I needed to know at absorbing the rhythms of legislative life by walking the halls, at preparing committee hearing questions for my boss that might get picked up by the press, at learning to anticipate his political needs, and to use his position to advance my issues too. At succumbing to the lure of the closed room, and the subtle power rush that comes from hearing words I wrote come out of someone else's mouth. After 2 years at Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, I returned to politics and signed on with the Dukakis for President campaign. This was a no-brainer. A Greek-American liberal from Massachusetts was running for president. How could I not work for him? After volunteering in the primaries, I moved to Boston for what I thought would be a short, happy hiatus before returning to Washington with a new president. When I arrived, we had a 17-point lead. Then came the summer assault. The Bush campaign, led by Lee Atwater, opened up a disciplined, ruthless, and sustained series of attacks on Governor Dukakis' record and character. Flags, furloughs, the Pledge of Allegiance, Willie Horton became a household name. By August's Republican convention, our lead was gone, our candidate was a caricature, and our campaign was effectively over. A few months after the election, I got a call from Kirk O'Donnell. A veteran of former Speaker Tip O'Neill's operation, Kirk had also been my boss in the Dukakis campaign, and was now a Washington lawyer scouting talent on the side for Dick Gephardt. "George, would you consider coming back to Washington to be Dick Gephardt's floor man?" "Consider? Are you kidding?" Kirk was offering me a starting job in the Democratic Party's major league, the House leadership. Majority Leader was one step away from Speaker, who was two steps away from the President. As executive floor assistant to Gephardt, I would be his shadow, his surrogate, his eyes and ears. Although I had never met the man, I knew Gephardt was a good Democrat, and there was a bonus. In 1992, he was planning to run again for president. 2 years into my job, Gephardt was looking at the 1992 presidential race, commissioning polls, testing the water in Iowa and New Hampshire. Although my job was legislative work, he took me aside in the early summer to ask me what I thought. Should he seek the Democratic nomination in 1992? "Absolutely," I told him. "You're well known and you've run before. You can beat anyone else in the race." Only Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa and former Senator Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts had announced. "Even though Bush is popular," I continued, "someone has to take on this fight. It will be good for the party and the country." But Gephardt had voted for Bush's unpopular tax increase and against his popular war, and he was coming from a Congress that had raised its own pay and been bogged down in a check-cashing scandal. It seemed like the only voters not angry at Congress in 1991 were the ones too alienated from politics to care at all. In an outsider's year, the majority leader was Mr. Inside. Knowing that, he wisely decided to stay where he was. But I didn't want to stay. Restrained idealism and raw ambition, the pistons of my character were powering up again, pushing me to find someone new. Bill Clinton wasn't my type. He was a Southern conservative, I was a Northern liberal. He was a governor, I was a creature of Congress. I hadn't met him, and I'd heard him speak only once before, at the 1988 Democratic Convention, where his droning nomination of Dukakis drew sustained applause only for the words, "in conclusion." But friends of mine who knew him well insisted I would like him. I met Clinton in September 1991 at the townhouse office of Stan Greenberg, a former Yale professor turned pollster who had signed on with Clinton. I didn't know what to expect, but had plenty of time to wonder, because Clinton was late. When he walked into the room, I got the full treatment. Bulky and butter-cheeked, Clinton looked like an overgrown boy in his light summer suit. But he had the gait of a man used to being obeyed, admired, courted, and loved. Slow but not stately, almost lazy, but loaded with self-confidence. Political advisor Mark Guerin introduced me with a light setup. "You know George's work. He wrote jokes for Dukakis." "Not really," I demurred. "They just needed a short Greek with no sense of humor to test market the lines." Clinton held my eye with a smile while he shook my hand. His was soft, and the grip was surprisingly light for a politician. "Sounds to me like you have a sense of humor," he said. "What else do you do?" Mark and Stan left us alone, and Clinton started to putter around the office, picking up books, poll questionnaires, photos, anything that caught his eye. He seemed to know something about everything, from the party rules for picking superdelegates to turnout in black precincts on Super Tuesday, from how the credit crunch was bankrupting small businesses in New Hampshire to how microenterprise loans could help farmers in the Mississippi Delta. And he swooped from issue to issue without losing his thread, punctuating his soliloquy with questions from me. By the time he closed, with the prediction that the nomination would be decided on the day of the Illinois primary, I was blown away. We were working together from the moment we met, and Clinton and I were in sync on the issues I cared most about. His belief that the role of government was to open opportunities to people who work hard and play by the rules appealed to my Greek work ethic. So did his devotion to education, from Head Start to student loans to worker retraining, and he had made progress in Arkansas. He wanted to raise taxes on the rich and cut them for the working poor. He wanted national health care and a domestic peace corps. Unlike most Southerners, he didn't kowtow to the National Rifle Association. On race, he was willing to fight for what was right in a state where they once had to call in federal troops to end segregation in the schools. He'd never let the Republicans get away with Willie Horton. But I was moved by more than what he stood for or how much he knew. It was how I felt around him, uniquely known and needed, as if my contribution might make all the difference. The day before Clinton announced, I was formally offered a job, deputy campaign manager for communications, a loosely defined slot in which I'd be responsible for figuring out how policy issues would play in the press and political world. Although my duties were not defined with precision, I didn't press for clarification. I wanted the freedom to freelance, and I was too excited and grateful to raise the other awkward questions my friends were urging me to ask before signing on, the rumors about Clinton and women. Our campaign grew fast through the fall. We traded up headquarters, and David Wilhelm built up our field organization, working back from Illinois to Florida, where the first symbolic votes would be cast at a straw poll in December. His buddy, Rahm Emanuel, came down from Chicago to run the money. I divided my time between setting up shop in Little Rock and accompanying Clinton on the road. Bruce Lindsay, Clinton's old friend and aide-de-camp, took care of the body. I concentrated on press and policy, briefing Clinton before interviews on likely questions and the reporter's angle, checking in with our consultants back in Washington, reading newspapers, magazines, and policy journals for news hooks and new facts to freshen the stump speech. The professionals with the hot hand that fall were James Carville and Paul Begala. Earlier that month, they had guided former John F. Kennedy aide Harris Wofford to an upset landslide victory in his Pennsylvania Senate race against Bush Attorney General Richard Thornburg. Every Democrat in the country hoped the race was a harbinger for 1992, and most of the candidates wanted to hire the men who had helped make it happen. Paul Begala and I were friends from our days together on Gephardt's staff. The speeches he produced had perfect populist pitch, pithy, funny, aimed straight at the lazy Susans of middle-class kitchen tables. With his lizard-like looks and colorful patois, Carville was the better-known partner. But James wouldn't be James without Paul. James had his own gift, a sixth sense about politics, a down-home genius that can't be taught. He was the first person I heard say that President Bush could be beat. It was in May 1991 at Paul's 30th birthday party. We met by the bar where James was pouring himself a bourbon. He filled my glass, too, while assuring me that Bush was going to lose if we had the right candidate. I remembered the prediction because I wanted it to be right, but was sure it was wrong. In November 1991, Clinton and I met Carville and Begala at the bar of Washington's Grand Hotel, where Clinton ordered decaf and the rest of us had a drink. Within minutes, Carville and Clinton were competing. Who knew more about politics? Who was the real Southerner? Who had the most sophisticated take on Super Tuesday's primary chessboard? After Carville and Begala left, Clinton turned to me in the elevator and said, "Those guys are smart." Which meant, of course, they agreed with Clinton. They also signed up with us a couple of weeks later, and the Washington Post reported that we treated it as the December equivalent of winning the New Hampshire primary. At the end of 1991, after Mario Cuomo decided not to run, not a single vote had been cast, but the complicated, almost alchemic process that creates conventional wisdom had made Clinton the frontrunner. A similar process was solidifying my spot in Clinton's inner circle. The daily phone calls, endless meetings, late-night games of hearts on the plane, and early morning reviews of the morning headlines were deepening the bond. Our team was starting to gel. Dee Dee Myers came in from California to be press secretary, and Bruce Reed moved down from D.C. to run the issue shop. But the rumors about Clinton and women were bubbling just below the surface, Over the next month, my fears were calmed by rising poll numbers and the absence of dropping shoes. But that artificial sense of security disappeared on January 16th, our first garbage day. The Star tabloid was faxing around a story alleging that Clinton had affairs with five Arkansas women, including Jennifer Flowers, a former lounge singer, and Elizabeth Ward, a former Miss America. The allegations had first been raised in Clinton's 1990 gubernatorial race, when a state employee named Larry Nichols filed a libel suit against Clinton. But the women denied the rumors, the story evaporated, and Clinton won re-election. After we landed in Boston that afternoon, I read the just-received Star story to Clinton. Any worries I had were assuaged when Clinton went on to explain that Nichols and his right-wing allies were out for revenge because the governor had fired Nichols for using official state phone lines to raise money for the Nicaraguan Contras, and when he added that all five women had filed sworn affidavits in 1990 denying the charges. That was all the ammunition I needed. The facts still seemed to be on our side, and Clinton's accuser had a motive, revenge. This was a smear campaign. We wanted to avoid an on-the-record denial if possible, not only because it would create a story, but also because if Clinton denied some allegations, his silence about others could be construed as confirmation. Since Clinton had admitted to problems in his marriage, we knew there had to be at least one woman out there whose charges he couldn't deny. More likely, many more. So we tried to avoid the trap by attacking the tabloid messenger. Paul cooked up some lines about other Star scoops like the discovery of alien babies, and I came up with a no-comment denial. I'm not going to comment on that tabloid trash. Beating back the first Star story was relatively easy. The sworn affidavits did the real work. Besides, I believed Clinton, and believed even more in what he was trying to do. But a week later, Jennifer Flowers flipped. Another Thursday, another Star story, another garbage day. But this one was more serious. A key witness for the defense was now part of the prosecution, and she said she had tapes. Carvel and I landed in Manchester, New Hampshire in an icy rainstorm and drove straight to the Holiday Inn. Inside was a gaggle of reporters, big feet like Al Hunt of the Wall Street Journal, Jules Witkover of the Baltimore Sun, Curtis Wilkie of the Boston Globe, and James Wooten of ABC News. We tried to hustle Clinton up to our suite, where Bruce, James, the governor, and I all read the article at once, trading the pages back and forth. "They made love all over her apartment," read one headline. Clinton read the piece with a running commentary that picked up speed as he skimmed the paragraphs. Every time he spotted a detail he knew was wrong, he seized on it, even squeaking out a laugh when he found charges he knew we could disprove. Whatever had happened between him and Jennifer, and I still didn't know, he could prove that elements of her story were untrue. I was happy to make a list of the details that were false, but I didn't press Clinton to say which ones were true. I wanted to believe that it was all malicious fiction, to see Clinton as he saw himself, the target of unscrupulous enemies who would try to destroy him personally because they opposed his policies. And I needed Clinton to see me as his defender, not his interrogator, which made me, in the end, an enabler. Okay, I thought. Say he's lying about some stupid one-night stand. It's still not fair for him to have his whole past picked apart. He's already said he didn't have a perfect marriage. What more do they want? And what does it matter? What does that have to do with being president? The tabloids are targeting him to make money. The right-wingers are attacking him because they're afraid he'll win and afraid of what he'll do. We can't let them get away with it, or they'll never stop. By the time we returned to the lobby, I was in a lather. We didn't have the silver bullet of Jennifer's sworn denial anymore, but her story was full of holes, and she did have a motive to lie. The Star was paying her to tell this tale. The next day's papers were filled with stories, and Jennifer scheduled a press conference for Monday. 350 reporters showed up at Jennifer's press conference, and CNN was broadcasting live. Didn't start out so badly. Jennifer's red suit and dark-rooted hair sent exactly the right message. A question about Clinton and condoms from Stuttering John of the Howard Stern Show helped make the event seem like more of a circus than a serious political scandal. Jennifer even said she'd been approached by Republicans to tell her story. There's an opening. Maybe we can turn this into an anatomy of a smear story instead of a morality play about Clinton's character. Then came the tapes. Scratchy but apparently authentic recordings of Clinton and Jennifer talking in intimate tones about their personal relationship in the presidential race. hearing Clinton's unmistakably husky voice felt like picking up the phone to catch your girlfriend whispering with another man. My whole torso tightened as I was hit by a wave of nausea, doubt, embarrassment, and anger. Mostly anger. I thought to myself, he lied. Even if he didn't, what's he doing talking to her in the middle of the campaign? When Jennifer finished, Rahm Emanuel, David Wilhelm, and I retreated to a private office. We didn't know what was true anymore, or what was going to happen. All we could trust right now was each other. There comes a time in every campaign where even a candidate you admire becomes your worst enemy. As if by design, each of us in turn expressed our disgust while the other two bucked him up. Tag team venting. It worked. And as the night passed, we were back to fighting for Clinton even more fiercely. A dynamic that had already started and would repeat itself many times in the years ahead took hold of me, one explained well by Reinhold Niebuhr. Frantic orthodoxy, he wrote, is never rooted in faith, but in doubt. It's when we're not sure that we're doubly sure. I now had doubts about Clinton, had seen his flaws up close, which caused me to focus even more intently on his strengths and believe even more fervently in his ideas. I didn't want to throw away what he could achieve as president and what I could achieve by his side, and I didn't want our enemies to win. Now I was a true, true believer. Hillary rallied all of us that night with a conference call from Minneapolis, foreshadowing another pattern that would be repeated again on a larger stage. If she was standing by her man, then so were we. A Boston TV poll showed that Clinton was still leading in New Hampshire, and a national survey on Nightline found that 80% of the country thought Clinton should stay in the race. We'd survive to fight another day. Colonel Gene Holmes was the Jennifer Flowers of the draft. In 1969, he was the ROTC commander at the University of Arkansas. After a year at Oxford, Clinton had returned to Fayetteville, enrolled in law school, and sought to fulfill his obligation for military service by joining the ROTC unit commanded by Holmes. Later that summer, Clinton changed his mind and returned to Oxford, but avoided military service by drawing a high number in the lottery that determined who would be drafted. This is what I knew about Clinton in the draft when I signed up. What I didn't know is what had not been reported, that Clinton's version picks up the story after he had received an induction notice from his local draft board. In 1969, Clinton gamed the Selective Service system and got lucky. The full story of Clinton in the draft is an anxiety-ridden tale of manipulation and mendacity, similar to thousands of others from the 1960s. But as an aspiring Arkansas politician in the 1970s, Clinton didn't want to be defined by his unflattering draft history. So instead of telling the whole story, he pointed anyone who asked about the draft to Colonel Holmes, who as late as October 1991 assured reporters that he had dealt with Clinton just like I would have treated any other kid. Flash forward to Wednesday, February 5th, 1992. We were still in the lead despite the Jennifer story, but Clinton had come down with a bad flu. So we canceled our schedule for the day and put him to bed in a New Hampshire motel. As he rested in the next room, I returned a phone call from Jeff Birnbaum of the Wall Street Journal. The post-it read, "Clinton and the draft." The moment Jeff answered the phone, I knew we were in trouble. He wasn't interested in having a conversation or in getting a feel for how our side assessed the campaign and our opponents. He had specific questions about when Clinton joined the ROTC and whether he enrolled in law school in the summer of 1969, and he didn't want to have a debate with me on whether that information was relevant to voters in the winter of 1992. When I went into Clinton's room, he was sick, flat on his back and too groggy to get worked up. Even so, he was fairly convincing about having nothing to hide. I have no idea what he could be getting at, Clinton wheezed through his congestion. Tell him to call Gene Holmes. Which was exactly what Birnbaum had done. But Holmes, like Jennifer Flowers, had changed his story. Now he was saying that he felt Clinton's promise to join the ROTC was merely a pretext to avoid the draft, suggesting that Clinton had manipulated both him and the system. Except for failing to mention the fact that Holmes had changed his account, Birnbaum's article was more solid than we knew or could admit. The draft did all the damage Jennifer didn't do. As Clinton would later joke, we dropped like a turd in a well, falling to third place in 3 days. But on the Sunday night we found out, he wasn't in a humorous mood. Pacing around his family room in jeans while Hillary sat at a card table in her sweats, Clinton went on a self-delusional tirade. "It's that damn middle-class tax cut. It's killing us." Grow up, I thought. If it weren't for that tax cut, we'd be dead last. That's what people like about you. It's everything else they're sick of. But I stayed silent, and Hillary stayed focused. She knew the self-pity would pass if we had a plan. We spent the rest of the night drafting new commercials and a fight-like-hell strategy for the last 10 days. The next morning, we flew back to Manchester lightheaded from lack of sleep, but liberated by the prospect of having little more to lose. It was February 10th, my 31st birthday, and Mark Halperin of ABC News had a present for me. When we landed in Manchester, he was waiting on the tarmac. Mark had been with our campaign nearly as long as I had, and we were as close to friends as possible given our adversarial roles. The look on his face as he walked my way was all the commentary I needed on what he held in his hands. "Nobody else has this," he said. "Read it right away. We're going to need a response." Even before the document touched my hands, my eyes took in three details: the Oxford University seal at the top of the first page, the phrase "Dear Colonel Holmes," and a line I still can't read without getting sick to my stomach: "I want to thank you, not just for saving me from the draft." My knees went wobbly. Lack of sleep and scandal fatigue were taking their toll. That's it. We're done. I was certain we were holding the political equivalent of a death warrant. Although it was a thoughtful letter that expressed both respect for the military and principled opposition to the Vietnam War, Clinton didn't post it until after he received a high number in the draft lottery. At a minimum, it suggested that Clinton was stringing Holmes along and holding on to his coveted ROTC slot until after he was certain he wouldn't be drafted. Our next stop was the Stony Hill Yogurt Factory in Londonderry, where Jim Wooten would do the interview we had promised Halperin. As Clinton toured the factory floor, I stayed in the back room, where I lay on the floor feeling sorry for myself. Staring up at the ceiling, I felt like I was back on the high school wrestling mat, just before a match against someone who would probably kick my butt. "At least it'll be over soon," I thought. "We'll be knocked out of the race, and here's where it all began to end. On the cold stone floor of a yogurt factory, waiting for the final interview. Happy birthday." The gala was as bleak as I was. We tried to prep Clinton, but there was really nothing we could say. Only he knew what happened and why. Wooten taped a short interview before turning off the camera, asking for 5 minutes alone with Clinton. Paul, Halperin, and I watched them talk through a window in the hall, trying to read their lips for any sign of how it was going. Expecting the worst, I was certain that Wooten was just doing his best to soften the blow of a killer story. Neither of them said a word after they shook hands, and we parted company. But 30 minutes later, Halperin beat me. The story was off. We had a stay of execution. But not for long. The next day, Nightline also had the letter. Clinton went on Nightline. Answering the questions was our only hope. Koppel first asked Clinton if he wanted to read the letter on the air. But we weren't that dumb. A clip from Clinton reading one damaging line out of context would be replayed endlessly. Instead, Koppel read the letter himself and gave Clinton the whole show to explain himself. Clinton was masterful, calm about the past, impassioned about the future, with just the right degree of indignation about the kind of issues that ought to matter when electing a president. In the final minute of the show, he squeezed in a sterling soundbite. "Ted, the only times you've invited me on this show are to discuss a woman I never slept with and a draft I never dodged." Even had I known then that Clinton's closing statement wasn't really true, I would have had a hard time admitting it to myself. I was in battle mode. And nearly anything we did, I believed, was justified by what was being done to us. Tabloid reporters were prowling the streets of Little Rock offering cash for stories about Clinton. Almost all the rumors swirling around our increasingly gothic campaign, that Clinton sanctioned drug running from Arkansas's MENA airport, that Clinton was a cocaine fiend, that Hillary was a secret lesbian, were both malicious and untrue. The final weekend before the New Hampshire primary was a blur. I was sure all was lost, but Clinton demonstrated the power of pure will. He was determined to touch and talk to every person in New Hampshire he could get his hands on. We staffers left the suite in shifts to accompany him, but we were superfluous. This was all about Clinton, his pride, ambition, and anger. his need to be loved, and his drive to do good. Watching him made me wonder if you have to be a little crazy to become president. What does it do to you to want something so badly? What I didn't realize at the time was how the focus on Clinton's problems was paradoxically helping him, turning the New Hampshire primary into a referendum on what politics should be about. Clinton was channeling public disgust and transforming it into a reason to vote for him. The best way to strike a blow against the obsession with scandal was to vote for the candidate most plagued by scandal. Never mind that Clinton brought many of the problems on himself, he also offered a way out, and he was a kick to watch. No matter how hard you hit him, he popped up smiling. When the exit poll started to come in, we ordered cheeseburgers from room service and started banging out a victory memo on Bob Boorstin's laptop. Of course, coming in second to Tsongas wasn't technically a victory, but it sure felt like one after all we'd been through. Even Clinton, the eternal optimist, seemed surprised by the news. Our near victory suppressed my new doubts about Clinton. Success has a way of doing that. My initial infatuation was maturing into a more complicated bond. Clinton wasn't a hero, just a man, with flaws as profound as his gifts. But he was by far the best politician I'd ever met. He had more ideas than anyone in the race. His heart was in the right place, and he refused to quit. Together, we still might do some good, and he was still my ticket to the top. We formally clinched the nomination with a win in California on June 2nd. In the single best decision of the campaign, Clinton picked another young Southerner, Al Gore, as his running mate. After the Democratic convention made the nomination official, Clinton and Gore rode a fleet of buses across I-80 towards New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Illinois, the battleground states. I stayed behind to enjoy a lazy day in Manhattan before flying to Little Rock with James. Not being on the bus made me wonder if I was missing something, the excitement of the crowds and the connection with the country. But 2 months before, on a flight to Minneapolis, Clinton had pulled me aside on the plane and reassigned me to Little Rock headquarters. Our campaign was balkanized and adrift, and our whole team of consultants threatened to quit if things didn't change. James outlined the demands, a complete overhaul of our headquarters and operating philosophy. The Republicans were pros. They had won 3 presidential campaigns in a row, and they were ruthless. We had to be battle-ready just to be in the game, to break down the bureaucracy and replace campaign by conference call with a single strategic center for attacks and counterattacks. Hillary got it immediately. "What you're describing is a war room," she said, giving us both a name and an attitude. The purpose of the war room wasn't just to respond to Republican attacks. It was to respond to them fast, even before they were broadcast or published, when the lead of the story was still rolling around in the reporter's mind. Our target was the public's filter for information. Our goal was to ensure that no unanswered attack reached real people. James would be the general, but he needed a second in command. Paul was the logical choice, but his wife was due to deliver their first baby that summer, so he couldn't move to Little Rock. That left me. Clinton knew I was reluctant to leave his side, to relinquish the power that accompanies proximity. But working in the war room gave me the chance to prove myself away from Clinton's shadow. Back in Little Rock, we traded up headquarters again to a 4-story gray stone building that had recently housed the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Our 4th-floor war room was the paper's old newsroom. Carville's command post was a fold-out conference table flanked by a couch where we held our twice-daily meetings. Scattered around the room were outposts for every campaign department: research, press, issues, field, and all the rest. 4 TV sets suspended from the ceiling provided us with instant access to CNN, network news, and other necessities like Seinfeld, sports, and Showtime. The war room never closed. Day and night, teams of young volunteers worked in shifts, tracking every Bush move on their computers. On the roof, a satellite dish pulled in broadcasts, including the occasional intercept of a still-unaired Republican commercial on its way to a local affiliate. Much of this technology was relatively new. But for all our high-tech toys, the most useful item in the war room was a low-tech template, a hand-lettered whiteboard that James stuck on a pillar in the middle of the room. Change versus more of the same. The economy, stupid. Don't forget healthcare. I thought of it as a campaign haiku, an entire election manifesto condensed to 18 syllables. I was the first senior staffer to arrive in the morning, getting in around 6:15, unless I had an even earlier appearance on one of the morning shows. After the morning meeting, James and I would retreat to my office with a handful of other staffers for a conference call with our counterparts on the road. Clinton would then get on the line to make sure that we weren't making strategy without him. He knew how easily a candidate could get out of the loop of his own campaign. I spent the rest of the morning gathering intelligence, swapping information, and trying to shape the news, concentrating on our beat reporters, the journalists on President Bush's plane, and my old contacts on Capitol Hill. After lunch at my desk, I'd check in with the producers at the national networks. In the afternoon, we'd meet with the other consultants to review the research, draft ads, look over the long-term schedule, and bullshit about the race. Sometimes I'd grab a quick nap on Carville's couch. Then we'd enter the shoot towards news time. Around 9:30, we'd have a late dinner, usually at Doe's, a Spartan steakhouse with formica tables and linoleum floors. Doe's was where the reporters wanted to eat when they came to town, which made our backroom table the campaign equivalent of the cool corner at the high school cafeteria. We always invited reporters to eat with us, partly because it was our job, partly because it was fun, and partly because they paid the check. My day ended around 11. I'd fall asleep on a full stomach within minutes of getting home. About 6 hours later, I'd beat the alarm by a minute and get up to do it all again. It's true that no man can be a hero to his valet. But every day, Clinton also showed how extraordinary he was. Like when he spent his downtime stroking the hand of a little girl, bald and yellow with cancer, and looked into her eyes until she believed she'd grow up to be a movie star. Or when you'd prep him for a late-night car ride to the airport interview after 16 hours of nonstop campaigning. His eyes would float, the lids fluttering with fatigue. But once the reporter ducked into the back seat, Clinton would repeat the briefing word for word and add 6 points we missed. We called him Secretariat, the ultimate political thoroughbred. Most of the time, I was just happy to be his stablemate, the little goat by his side, who usually knew what to say and had a knack for keeping him calm. By the fall, the rest of the country was starting to believe that Clinton was one of a kind, too. As his bus rolled across the Midwest and down through the South, he promised hope and personified change, which was exactly what people were looking for after 8 years of Reagan and 4 more of Bush. In late September, Stan Greenberg conducted a national poll that tested all the charges the Bush campaign could throw at us and every rebuttal we would give. Nothing the Republicans could try would work. On paper, at least, the election was ours. But the closer we got to Election Day, the more fearful we all became. With the press speculating openly about a Clinton landslide in public, we started driving each other crazy in private. James stopped changing his underwear. I stopped sleeping. Clinton, egged on by Hillary, obsessed about Perot. I'm telling you, this guy's coming on, and it's all going to come from me. Our anxiety peaked on the Thursday before Election Day. Bush had spent Wednesday barnstorming Ohio by train, and our overnight polls there showed a drop from 17 points up to 3 points down in 24 hours. If the same tactic worked in Michigan, Iowa, and Wisconsin over the weekend, we could actually lose. CNN confirmed our fears by releasing a national poll that showed our overall lead had dropped to a single point within the margin of error. Even though we suspected that CNN was cooking the results to inject a little excitement into the race, we couldn't be sure. But our worries that Thursday ended when President Bush stopped his own mini-surge by calling Clinton and Gore bozos at a campaign rally in suburban Michigan. The next day, his fading hopes and our remaining fears were put to rest. Iran-Contra independent counsel Lawrence Walsh had just indicted former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, and a note included in the indictment indicated that Bush had both known about and supported trading arms for hostages, a charge the president had repeatedly denied. The Weinberger note was the closest thing yet to a smoking gun. Bush's campaign was dead anyway, but this was the nail in the coffin. That night, I did a little jig on the grave. I was at the gym when Michael Waldman, our campaign specialist on Iran-Contra and other Bush scandals, beat me to let me know that Bush was on Larry King Live, challenging King to ask him anything. I jumped into my car with a cell phone and dialed Tammy Haddad, King's executive producer. "Tammy, Larry's letting Bush off the hook. How could he not know they were trading arms for hostages?" "Good question," she replied. "Why don't you ask him yourself?" Figuring a little confrontation would make for good television, she gave me a special number to connect directly with the show. Good television, maybe, but was it smart politics? We had the lead, why take a chance? If I said something stupid and the election turned, then I personally, not Clinton or James or anyone else, could conceivably be responsible for the loss. It really would be all my fault. But we had come this far by never letting up, by being in their face every minute of every day. This was no time to change tactics. James was all for it, but I wanted higher clearance. I couldn't reach Clinton, so I tried Gore. Had he vetoed the idea, I would have backed off. Had he been unavailable, I would have had to make a choice. Go for it, he said. I dialed the number. As I waited on hold, all the moisture in my mouth drained into my palms. Suddenly, the line opened into what sounded like a wind tunnel. I was on the air. King announced a call from Little Rock, Arkansas, and for the first time in my life, I was talking to a sitting president. Mr. President, you asked us to find out what the smoking gun was, I said, before citing the Weinberger memo as evidence that Bush had to know Iran-Contra was an arms for hostages deal. May I reply, Bush said, sounding peeved but still in control. He next surprised me by reciting my resume on national television. Where's he going with this? He told the viewers I was a very able young man who had once worked for Congressman Richard Gephardt. That's it, trying to tie me to the congressional Democrats. But pretty nice to call me able, considering I'm trying to throw him out of office. Then he finally answered my question by saying that President Reagan didn't believe it was arms for hostages and that he believed President Reagan. Nothing new. Larry King. George, want to respond? President Bush. I didn't come here to debate Stephanopoulos. Wait a minute. He's debating 6-foot chickens all over the country, but he won't debate me? King tried again to get me to respond, but Bush cut him off. He filibustered by praising me again, saying I was a patient fellow, and that every time we'd say something, he was out there with a response, a rejoinder, a retort, anything. Just finish the sentence. And they did a very good job on it, the president concluded. In that spontaneous encounter, Bush revealed his state of mind and the condition of his campaign. He seemed to be acknowledging that our team was better than his. And by speaking in the past tense, Bush seemed to be admitting that the election was over, an idea which became even more explicit a moment later when he offered what sounded to me like a presidential seal of approval. So I would like to take this opportunity, because I might not have a chance to see him before the election, to commend George on all that. Later that night, Clinton called to congratulate me. But from the tone of his voice, I could tell that he was a little annoyed. And why not? Calling Larry King's producer was my job, but confronting an incumbent president was a risk, and not necessarily a prudent one. Good thing it worked. After the 11 a.m. exit polls confirmed an Electoral College landslide, Election Day was a blur of high fives and hugs. But Clinton didn't trust exit polls. Back in the mansion, he inhaled the results I fed him in hourly phone calls, but refused to let himself believe them. Only when the official tally came in later that night did the anxious man revert to the hyper-competent Paul. As I read off the list of states we'd won over my cell phone, Clinton became nonchalant. I knew that. Yeah, I figured we'd win there, too. I tried to thank him for changing my life. Helping him win was the best thing I'd ever done, but he wanted an update on Nevada. Our campaign relationship ended as it had begun. Two men at work, talking shop, a candidate and his staff. The formalities were for the rest of the world. They would get the waves and smiles, the gracious words, the promise to face the future with humility and hope. I got, how'd we do in Nevada? My own personal victory speech. Shit, I can't cover it up. I was staring at the mirror of the single-stall washroom by the press secretary's office on the first floor of the West Wing of the White House. In a few minutes, I would call my first official press briefing, and I had a problem. My beard. With all the craziness of the inaugural, I hadn't had the chance to buy new razor blades, and the powder I was pasting on my cheeks gave me the pallor of a corpse with a 5 o'clock shadow. I was about to face the world from the White House podium, looking like an adolescent Richard Nixon. My job that day was to act like one of his henchmen, to hang Zoe Baird out to dry. Our nominee for attorney general, Baird was in the middle of a firestorm because her background check belatedly turned up both that she had failed to pay Social Security taxes for her household help and that the workers were illegal immigrants. As I prepared to face the White House press corps, she was getting pummeled by the Senate Judiciary Committee. She didn't know it yet, but she was toast. As the loudspeaker announced that my briefing would begin in 1 minute, I stood behind the wooden door to the press room with a stomach full of pleasant butterflies. I couldn't wait to get behind the podium and show what I could do. The sound of the door sliding open set off dozens of camera shutters. I walked to the podium, adjusted the glasses I had started wearing again in a vain attempt to look older, and took in the scene with a deep breath. The long, low room was more compact than it looks on television. A bank of video cameras on tripods anchored the back, and every movie theater seat in front was filled. Photographers crouched on the floor by the podium, and the aisles were stocked with an assortment of staff and other spectators. What they saw that day was a White House press secretary fall flat on his face. It opened well enough. I read a statement about the president getting down to work. Helen Thomas, the red-haired UPI reporter who had covered every president since Kennedy, started with a softball. Are there any more executive orders to be signed today? I don't believe there are any more today, Helen. Then the real questioning began. How about all these stories on the lifting of the ban on homosexuals in the military? What I thought was, how about you guys give it a rest and report decisions we've actually made? I know. It's too good to let go. Sex, a fight with the military, gays feeling betrayed, a crisis right out of the box. If you reporters weren't pumping it so much, maybe real people wouldn't think it's the only promise we're trying to keep. But we can't get Sam Nunn and the Joint Chiefs to give us a break yet, so I have nothing to say. What I said was, I think the president intends to end discrimination against homosexuals in the military, and would be very soon, probably within the next week, but not today. George, would the president like Zoe Baird to offer to withdraw her nomination? I thought, well, duh. Of course he would, wouldn't you? We're sucking wind on our first day with a candidate for attorney general who broke the law. But she says she told Warren Christopher about it before Clinton chose her, so it's our fault. And she doesn't want to quit without clearing her name. We're stuck. I said, no, he thinks she'll make an excellent attorney general. If Mrs. Baird decides to withdraw her name, would the president accept it? In a heartbeat. I wish that's what I was announcing right now. Right now, Mrs. Baird is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and President Clinton continues to believe she'll make a good attorney general. Damn, they caught that right now. Everyone's writing it down. They smell blood. Hope that doesn't make Zoe fight back harder. Did Mr. Clinton understand fully before naming her as his nominee for attorney general that she'd employed illegal aliens for this long period of time? Bingo. $64,000 question. Wish I knew the answer. He says no, Christopher says yes. Christopher probably mentioned it, but who knows exactly what he said or how Clinton heard it. All I know is that Zoe is saying publicly that she told us, so we're screwed either way. If we didn't know, we're incompetent hacks. If we did and appointed her anyway, we're unethical elitists. Some choice. I can't blame it all on Zoe. The president's not ready to accept responsibility and move on, but if I dump it in Christopher's lap, it'll hurt his credibility as Secretary of State. Got a punt. I said, again, I don't know the exact nature of his discussions on this. Nice try, but they were just getting warmed up. This was the heart of the matter, the old Watergate question. What did the president know and when did he know it? I didn't know and couldn't say. But I did know that I was dying out there, a fact confirmed by the flop sweat pouring out from under my arms and across my chest. When a reporter saved me from myself by saying thank you after 27 minutes of pounding, Helen Thomas shouted, "Welcome to the big leagues," and I hustled out of there with my head down like a rookie knocked from the mound in the first inning of his first game. Only hours before, I had gone to bed feeling like a world champion, after a round of inaugural balls capping off the headiest week of my life. After the failed Baird nomination and our first debacle over gays in the military, most of our time behind closed doors was spent struggling with our number one campaign promise, an economic plan to get the country moving again. From Election Day on, we'd been in endless meetings about how to reconcile our incompatible campaign promises to reduce the deficit, cut middle-class taxes, and increase investments in research, education, and training. Our economic team was split into battling camps. Bob Rubin, Lloyd Bentsen, and Budget Director Leon Panetta were the deficit hawks, with Gore on their side as the champion of a new energy tax. Liberal Labor Secretary Bob Reich led the charge for new investments, assisted by Gene Sperling and me. But Gene and I saw ourselves above all as guardians of the campaign promises. Our job was to see that what we did conformed to what we said we would do. Too bad that wasn't really possible. All our campaign estimates were off. The deficit was now larger than we projected. Our investments cost more. and our proposed budget cuts saved less. The economic plan we finally developed also seemed disappointing at first to a liberal like me. We had to drop the middle-class tax cut and drastically reduce the human capital investments proposed in the campaign. But we were hamstrung by the size of the deficit and the demands of the bond market. If we didn't reduce the deficit, the Federal Reserve and the market wouldn't force interest rates down. If interest rates stayed high, the economy wouldn't create jobs and growth. I didn't fully appreciate it then, but to achieve our overall goals for the economy, we had to sacrifice some specific promises. But many still survived. The earned income tax credit for the working poor, and our investments in education, including a national direct student loan program and the AmeriCorps National Service proposal. Maybe we couldn't achieve everything all at once, but we were making progress. Every day was a dozen meetings, 100 phone calls, a new crisis, another first. Obsessed by the idea that we had to keep all our promises at once, we were trying to do too much too fast. We were becoming exhausted. When you're brain dead, you make mistakes. My worst came the day of the FBI raid on cult leader David Koresh's compound in Waco, Texas. On April 19, 1993, as I stood at the podium for my daily noon briefing, CNN started broadcasting pictures of the compound in flames. Informed by his headquarters, CNN White House correspondent Wolf Blitzer asked me about the fire, but I had no idea what he was talking about. Then someone handed me a note, and I left the podium to find out what was going on. The rest of the day I was in constant contact with Associate Attorney General Webb Hubble, who was monitoring the situation for the Justice Department. They didn't have good information on what was happening in the compound either, or where David Koresh was, or whether the children were still alive. Later in the afternoon, I issued a statement saying the president was monitoring the situation and took full responsibility for its consequences. But the press was clamoring for the president in person. That's where I erred. Dee Dee and Bruce Lindsay pushed to have the president do a press conference, and he agreed at first. But I convinced him not to, out of fear that if he said something that triggered Koresh to kill the kids who might still be alive, then we'd be culpable. My motive may have been unassailable, but my judgment was dead wrong. The odds were high that everyone inside had already perished, and that nothing the president said could make the situation worse. Beyond that, the first rule in a presidential crisis is to take responsibility fully and openly. Don't duck. That's the Bay of Pigs lesson that should have been burned in my bones. When Attorney General Janet Reno appeared before the cameras, she was praised and the president was criticized, but it was my fault. My Waco error stemmed from inexperience and misplaced sentimentality. Other missteps, like the failed nomination of Lonnie Guinier, were the product of sloppy staff work coupled with an overactive desire to appease our liberal base with appointments because we couldn't deliver on policy. The defeat of our economic stimulus was the price we paid for legislative arrogance. Thinking we could roll right over the Republicans in the Senate, we rejected a moderate compromise offered by Senators Breaux and Boren and lost everything. That was Republican Senate leader Bob Dole's turn to show us who's boss. So much for opening like FDR or JFK. Our first 100 days were no honeymoon, and the president hadn't even had his hair cut yet. The first I heard about it was when my deputy Jeff Eller called from the plane to say that the press was grumbling about being late because of Clinton's haircut. What haircut, I asked. Jeff filled me in, and while we both thought it might turn into a problem, we didn't do anything, hoping it would pass into the ether of late-day events on Pacific Coast time. What we should have done was issue a preemptive apology. Even if he didn't mean it, Clinton should have walked to the back of the plane and said, "Sorry about the delay, folks, I screwed up." But we missed our chance. By filing time the next day, we were in crisis mode. Aided by some inaccurate leaks from the Federal Aviation Administration, the press reported that thousands of air travelers were delayed for the sake of the president's personal convenience. The truth is that while the reporters traveling with the president were delayed, no other air traffic at LAX was affected, but that didn't stop the paralyzed airport myth from hardening into accepted fact. The haircut might have been just another embarrassment if we hadn't simultaneously declared war on the press corps. The formal declaration was issued a little before noon on May 19th, when Dee Dee announced that 7 members of the White House Travel Office, the people whose job it was to care for the press on the road, had been fired. At the time, I was receiving an award at the commencement exercises of Columbia University, my alma mater. Sitting on the steps of Lowe Library in front of thousands of graduates and their families, I felt my beeper buzzing ceaselessly beneath my cap and gown. All hell was breaking loose back at the White House, and I had to get back. I raced through my speech and flagged a cab to the airport. As I rode, I pulled out my cell phone and started to return calls. The first was to Andrea Mitchell of NBC. "George, what are you guys doing firing the travel office?" she asked in mild disbelief, letting me know without saying so that we were making a big mistake. "Andrea, believe me," I replied. "Don't start defending the travel office. You'll be embarrassed." But we were the ones who ended up with egg on our faces. All I knew at the time was that we had uncovered some sloppy accounting in the travel office and that we were taking swift action. In hindsight, it's obvious that we should have quietly eased out the office director, Billy Dale, and his colleagues. Summarily firing them created a story about our management style rather than Dale's accounting practices. The more the press dug, the worse the story looked. Clinton's distant cousin, Catherine Cornelius, was angling to replace Dale, and a company run by Clinton's friend, Harry Thomason, appeared to be lining up for a piece of the White House travel business. The whole episode looked like small-time Arkansas self-dealing. I should have been paying enough attention to prevent the firing. After all, the office that made travel arrangements for the press was technically part of my department, but the issue involved two areas I did my best to avoid: administration and Arkansas. I knew that the Clintons' old Arkansas friends, David Watkins and Harry Thomason, were examining how the travel office was run, but my deputy Eller was handling it. After the story broke, I compounded our problems by asking the FBI public affairs officer to attend a meeting in my White House office so we could coordinate our public statements. Three White House lawyers attended the meeting, and I was only trying to make sure that what I was saying from the podium was true. But assured of my own good intentions, I was blind to how the meeting looked to the press. How could they possibly think that we're doing what Nixon did? Within a few days, I resembled Nixon's infamously incredible press secretary, Ron Ziegler, even more. In the briefing room, I did the Clintons' bidding, giving no ground, aggressively pushing back the inquiries, taking perverse pride in my daily pummelings as proof of my loyalty to Clinton and our cause. But much of what I said from the podium about the travel office matter turned out to be, as Ziegler used to say, inoperative. In the Oval, however, I was taking a different tack, arguing for more concessions, an apology here, more access there. That only made the Clintons believe I was going soft, pandering to the press at the president's expense. In the end, I wasn't strong enough to convince the Clintons that we were making a mistake, or skillful enough to give the press what they needed, even if it wasn't what the Clintons wanted. There was plenty of blame to go around. The Clintons were intransigent, and the reporters were self-absorbed. But they could all agree on at least one point, that I was doing a poor job. And they were right. Which meant that by Memorial Day, I was in the same condition as Zoe Baird on Inauguration Day. I should have seen it coming. A few weeks earlier, on a sunny afternoon in early May, Betty Curry buzzed me on the intercom and said the president wanted to see me on his putting green. I strolled down the sloping lawn to the manicured patch behind the Oval, where Clinton was hunched over in shirt sleeves. His suit coat lay by the side of the green, several golf balls were at his feet, and he was aiming at the farthest tiny flag. Without looking up, the president asked me what I thought of David Gergen, the former Reagan aide turned pundit. "He seems like a good guy," I answered, unaware of what Clinton was getting at. "Well, I was talking to him," Clinton continued, still putting. "He thinks maybe you're doing too much, and that you should think about dropping the briefing." The president doesn't like personal or personnel conflict. But here he was being a pretty good guy. He was letting me know what he wanted in a nice way, but I was too proud to take the hint. Back in Clinton's Little Rock family room during the transition, we had agreed that I would ease out of the briefings after the first 6 months. Now I resisted for fear it would look like a demotion. After my tip-off from the president, I should have prepared a graceful exit from the press room. Chief of Staff Mac McClarty was worried about his own job, and he knew that if he didn't make a high-profile change, then he would pay the price. On Thursday night, May 27th, just as our economic plan passed its first hurdle in the House, Mac reached a tentative agreement with Gergen to join the White House staff. Part of the deal was that I would give up the White House briefings and move into an undefined advisory role. Right after we won the House vote, Mac pulled me aside by the grand